This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Why did you feel like now was the time to write and release a book all about our approach to finances?
Well, I think that right now, in terms of economic ideas and economic thinking, that there is as much of a need as I have ever seen for people to have foundations, for people to have a basis for what they believe and why. I think there's a lot of economic ideas going around that are rooted in people's emotions, people's feelings, people's intuitions, but they're not thoughtfully constructed necessarily. Sometimes they can work out just fine. Sometimes there can be some wisdom to our intuitions, but I really desire to see people be more thoughtful in how they think about economics, and that this book is intended to sort of reaffirm some of those first principles, foundations.
And because for many of our listeners, we'll have varied backgrounds in economic study. For some of us, it's as basic as knowing how to add up maths, do the budget, and effectively put food on the table for the family. And others may be more in the arena of businesses and that kind of larger leadership level approach to finance. When you're talking about some of those foundational attitudes toward money that are important for us to have, what do you think is a healthy view of economics, something that helps us understand and the purpose of it?
I wrote the book around the belief that economics is fundamentally about the human person, that if we don't see economics as something that is to drive the process of human flourishing, a greater material and spiritual abundance, peace, joy for everyone, then I think we're missing the point of economics if we reduce it to merely the most efficient allocation of capital. So I want to see our thinking about economics start with the human person, with them finding their greatest purpose and having economic systems that help facilitate the cause of human flourishing.
Is that an attitude you've always had about the world of economics, or has that grown as you've worked in the industry throughout the last few years?
It is definitely an attitude that I believe I've always had, and yet one that has grown substantially over the last couple of decades. I think that throughout my career in finance, I've seen greater and greater need to reiterate humanity of economics, that when we sort of arrogantly assume that economics can be all reduced to a spreadsheet or to formulas, to charts and the like, which us financial people are prone to do, I think we miss out on some of the real magic of free enterprise, which is to me a system that helps cultivate the greatest attributes of the human spirit.
And it's interesting to me early on in your book that you do talk about people, humans being made in the image of God, and that then impacts the way that we would look at finance and that need to allow creativity in business and all of these sorts of elements. If you are approaching the world of finance from that belief that all of us are made in the image of God, how does that influence your approach to financial conversations and financial objectives?
Well, it starts with the belief that because we're made in the image of God, we have to kind of understand a little more what God made us for. How did he make us? What are the economic ramifications of this? So if you take the other extreme, the sort of Marxist view of the world, he had a very specific philosophy as well, but it was the polar opposite of mine. He believed that man was born to work and was fighting nature, that the notion of work actually was very empty and purposeless, and that it set up a whole system where the worker is constantly being exploited by a capitalist who is getting more value out of the worker's efforts than the worker is getting. And yet, I believe in free enterprise, you have a beauty to work. You have the opportunity to cultivate creation, that we were made with a productive and a creative and an innovative capacity that mirrors the creative, innovative, and productive capacity of our Creator. And I believe this out of my belief that we're made in the image of God. The Marxist view is sort of an extreme in terms of the opposite, but I use it only to illustrate how that theology or that anthropology, that belief about the human person, makes such a key difference in how we approach economics.
Mm, and can you just describe the concept of free enterprise? I know it's probably a very simple thing for you to be talking about, but for those who just need a bit of a framework for that perspective, what does free enterprise really mean and look like?
Oh, sure. I think it's a very fair question because it probably does mean different things to different people. But when I use it, I'm trying to use it at the highest level possible, the most generic, universally accepted idea of a market economy, one that is largely guided by free exchange, by free cooperation, that a system that primarily allows individual actors, producers, and consumers to transact with one another on terms that they mutually agree to and so forth. Mm. So it is really held out as against the notion of a central planning driven economy, one where there is an attempt to kind of guide, command, and control the affairs of economic transactions.
Right. And when you look at that in the context of the title of your book, There's No Free Lunch, that idea that for everything we're given, there's something we've kind of got to give back. You know, you don't get something without having to do something in return. Why did you want to bring that idea really front and center?
Well, I think that the concept behind the expression "there's no free lunch" is a very important economic law, the law of trade-offs. The belief that we live in a world that has scarce resources. And most economic fallacies, most mistakes people make, even individual financial mistakes or decisions that people make in their own lives, usually comes down to some forgetfulness about the law of trade-offs. We can recognize that we want to take a certain vacation, and at the same time that we want to hold on to our savings or our earnings from our paycheck, and we have to evaluate the trade-off between how much of our money we're willing to let go of in exchange for the enjoyment of a vacation. And there are cases where that vacation can be very worthwhile and worth not holding on to the money it costs to do so. And there are other times where we might say, I want to wait a little bit. I need to steward my capital for a little longer or whatnot. But what we can't ever do is pretend that we have it all, that there is such thing as a free lunch. Politicians, policymakers, business owners all often make this mistake. And what I have found so interesting in a lot of the interviews I've been doing for the book, I've been talking about the idea that five-year-olds usually understand this. So when they are trading toys on the playground with their friends, they know that they can't have everything, but they in their own minds are evaluating, well, how much do I want the bubble gum versus the baseball cards versus, you know, this other toy, and they think through the level of happiness they're going to get from different items and how they're going to feel about getting rid of other items, and that's really what economics comes down to, is that allocation of scarce resources, and we make big mistakes when we forget that there's no free lunch in this law of trade-offs.
So in terms of working out what a good trade-off is to make, I mean, that's probably going to vary based on the situation, circumstance, the different sort of elements you're looking at managing. But what would you say to somebody is kind of a healthy process, I suppose? How do you work out what a good trade-off is to make? Do you have a system around that?
Well, the beauty of it is that I don't believe that there is a system that I can make for somebody else's trade-offs. Now, obviously, there's certain best principles. There's formulas out there that people could look to about the level of mortgage they might want to take, or the level of student debt, or how much of their income they want to allocate for spending versus savings. But in terms of the way in which we live our lives, and I'm speaking now more philosophically than practically, humans have this innate ability to act, to make rational decisions. And I have to make those risk, reward, and cost benefits analyses in my own life, just as everyone else has to make it in theirs. And I believe the only thing that we really can do wrong is allow someone who doesn't have knowledge of a particular person's goals and situation, who doesn't understand one's specific time and place realities and sets rules for everyone as opposed to allowing for individuality. And that's what the central planning view of a society is intended to do, is reduce everyone's view of trade-offs to one lowest common denominator, when in reality, I truly believe that each person has individuality, and out of that, they have to act with freedom of choice and rationality about their own trade-offs.
So would you say that a free economic, or free enterprise rather, approach to the world of finance is more healthy and more individualized than perhaps a socialist one?
Well, I definitely think it's more healthy. I think it's more moral. I think it's more just. I think it creates a more efficient outcome. And I think it better honors the dignity of each person. So whether we're talking ethically or philosophically or practically, I think the testimony of history is abundantly clear that free enterprise is a far superior system to any other ever concocted by man.
What are some of the pieces of knowledge you think really help people make wise, independent financial choices? If we're not going to live in a socialist society, if we're living in the one of free enterprise, how do you give people confidence to make financial choices on their own?
Well, when you get past the kind of economic theory that the book is about, and people having foundational truths to how they understand economics, and from there go into practical or personal finance, which I think is what you're asking about now, then I think it really does become a very important matter of the proper level of financial education, which we've also failed to do in many developed societies, many developed nations, giving people an idea of how budgeting works, of how compounding works, meaning when they invest, what the compounding of the returns on their capital can do for them over time. A lot of people don't understand what they're investing in when they invest. Why do people go into the stock market or the bond market or real estate? Where do investment returns come from? Are they just magic? Are they just hocus pocus? Or is there some sensible, coherent logic to why certain investments generate a return over time? What are the risks that we take? And how do we mitigate those risks? Fundamentally, I think the answer to your question comes down to what people need is education in avoiding financial mistakes. A person who produces more than they consume has the opportunity to build wealth in society. That part is rather simple. Now, not everyone does it, but everyone intuitively ought to know that wealth creation comes from producing more than you consume. But then the personal finance and practical ramifications come down to what one does with that delta, the difference between what they produce and what they consume, and allowing for a worldview and a thought process to have financially organized and structured goals to help go manage and steward that delta between one's production and their consumption. That becomes the stuff that gives people financial freedom and independence.
So what's your recommendation? I mean, yeah, we're not going to do personalized finance advice for everybody listening. I understand that. But from a basic point of view, what would your advice be to people with what to do with that bit more, that extra?
Well, I think it comes down to defining one's goals, and we like to define them in the context of short-term, mid-term, and long-term. So, for example, most people might have in the short-term the need for an emergency savings account, maybe the need to reduce debt, the need for a down payment on a home. There are short-term goals, and then there are solutions that can be found that are matched up to those goals. Then you go down the time continuum a little bit into more intermediate goals. And of course, longer term, there's wealth building, there's estate, inheritance, legacy, charitable goals. Most financial planning has been developed around this notion of what we call retirement. And I understand it. I don't particularly like the word very much because I don't like the idea of ever not working. But I certainly understand the idea of not needing to work financially and developing more freedom and options for one in the later stages of their life, I'd see that as very different than the idea of a 30-year vacation. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that what most people fail to do is organize what their goals are, put a timeline around them, and then match solutions to those goals and to those timelines. And so I think that's what the process of financial planning ultimately is. Mm-hmm. And having that organization really puts people in a far better position than if they don't have any process at all.
It's true. We do kind of all need some level of sort of assistance, I would say, in that kind of goal setting process and working it out. Because I don't know what the situation is in the States compared to Australia necessarily, but I know here we don't really get a lot of education around finances in our school years. Unless you specifically study economics, which is more business oriented, it's really up to the individual at what point they start to pursue an interest in this and learn. And for some, it's as late as after school and even university. It's at the point where they're going, oh, I actually do need to kind of manage my finance as well. When would you start teaching people in your mind about these financial principles, and in what order would you roll out the aspects of finance they need to know?
So I think that there's three different things here. Very quickly, just at a very, very young age, when one is 6 years old, 9 years old, you know, myself as a parent, I like the idea of kind of teasing a foundation by not pretending that things bought on an app are free, not, you know, making clear that things cost money, making young people aware of the connection between work and compensation. So this at least creates a little bit of reality for them. It gives them kind of a milieu of realism in the way they think about finance and the world. It's so easy these days for people to believe money grows on trees because of all the technological innovations we've had. But then to your question, I really feel strongly that economics has to be taught before financial planning in a more systematic and formal way. And so I think that the right age where people have the maturity and the intellectual framework to absorb some of the basic introductory ideas is in high school. And so I like the idea of starting with a semester of economics 101, and then after that, having a financial planning education that is rooted in the foundations that they've already learned in economics, but then allows for more practical considerations about debt, about investment, about compounding capital, about goal setting and solution identifying, all these processes that we've been talking about, starting those things in the high school age so that people don't go after college, don't go off to the young adult years of their life with a total disconnection to reality as to how the world financially works.
Do you think that you'd get many people taking up the opportunity to introduce that education early? Because I know as much as we want to do finance in a great way, there are people that benefit from our financial mistakes. I think, you know, credit card companies, those that make any kind of interest off the debt that we may acquire that isn't really great for our financial situation. Is it possible to see a world that operates on healthy financial education, getting people out of these kind of mistakes? Do you think we would ever get there when some people do really benefit from our failures in our own finance?
Yes, because I don't believe that people who wish us harm ever have to prevail. Responsible, diligent, virtuous, truth-telling can always prevail over those who thrive off of other people's misfortune. The problem is not that the bad guys are winning, it's that the good guys aren't trying. The credit card companies may benefit from people's debt accumulation, but it isn't like there has been a concerted effort to counter that and that the credit card companies are simply winning. The reality is there's been very little effort. And I'll give you a great example as to why I think with the right intentionality and diligence, we can win. In a lot of professional sports leagues and clubs, there's been a systemic problem of large amounts of money going to people who have been ill-prepared to receive it for many years. They didn't have the education, the maturity, the responsibility, the discipline. And all of a sudden, after just a lot of horrible incidents and events and capital destruction, really bad actors taking advantage of people. A lot of the professional sports leagues started taking this very seriously, giving a lot of organized education, putting certified professionals in front of people. They can't make it foolproof. Somebody out there can still go blow all their money, but they've really put great guardrails in place to help people avoiding those things, despite the fact that there was a concerted effort from many others that didn't want that. They liked the ignorant base of people they could take advantage of. And yet through time, diligence and intentionality won. And that's what I think needs to happen across society.
Yeah, I wonder if they offer a similar kind of course to anyone that that wins the lotto. That'd be the next place to take a look at that. But in your book, you do talk about 250 economic truths. And of course, we haven't had a chance to, you know, we're going to drill into all of those. But what would be the ones that really stand out to you, perhaps a couple that are really sort of key truths that you want people to take away from your book?
Well, the number one, because in any interview, I don't get to do all 250. I really have focused on the one you and I talked about a few moments ago, which is the title of the book, the idea of there's no free lunch, and reiterating the principle of trade-offs. But I think that a couple of the other basic principles that are early in the book, because they're so foundational to everything else that the book talks about, is that restoration of the idea that economics is fundamentally about the human person. And so we want people to see the economic truth, the economic principle of human action, that humans have a unique capacity and unique attributes that enable economic activity and productivity. And that really is the great testimony of history, that humans acting in their own self-interest are capable of incredibly profound and prosperous things. And so it's a great theme of the book, that we do not have any new matter that we haven't had, any new natural resources that we haven't had, any new raw material that we haven't had for thousands of years, since the beginning of time. And yet out of all the initial creation, we have, through human ingenuity, through knowledge, ideas, brought to that raw material incredible increase in quality of life. And that is all the miracle of economics.
And I think there'd be some people who consider the idea of sort of approaching finances or approaching the world of economics from a personal gain point of view as missing something about generosity, of doing something for the world beyond yourself. And I know in listening to you and in reading your book that you do have a larger philosophical idea that informs the way you approach finance. So when we look at it from what the ultimate goal is, of whether it's personal wealth creation or stewarding our finance as well, all of that kind of stuff, what do you see as the ultimate goal of living well with your finances to be? Is it purely about personal acquisition, or is there a greater philosophical intention at play?
Well, there's definitely a greater philosophical intention at play, but that intention is not materialistic internally or externally. And so a lot of people, when they critique economic worldview that is internally materialistic, meaning how do I acquire more goods, they then turn it into something else equally materialistic by saying, no, the more noble and appropriate way to view life is how you can give goods to others. I do not reduce the human experience to materialistic ends, either for my own purposes or others. Rather, I believe there is the earned success that comes from an overall achievement of productive living. And that's what free enterprise is about to me, is the great ability for free people to pursue their own dreams and define their own dreams. And when we refer to charity and philanthropy, I believe in charity and philanthropy so much that I actually want to define it as something that is charitable and philanthropic. Coercion, compulsory giving, forced confiscation and redistribution is not charity. It is by definition not philanthropic to have something forced out of your hand into someone else's hand. It is only charitable when out of the abundance of my heart, I choose to give to others. And yet I have more resources to give to others, the more prosperous and capable I am. And I think I'm going to be more prosperous and capable when I pursue my dreams, not in the context of acquiring things, acquiring units of money, but rather pursue it as being the best I can be, serving mankind with goods and services in the most fulfilling way. There's an entire lifestyle, worldview to this free and virtuous society that I'm envisioning. And it, believe it or not, scratches the itches of all of these concerns far more than people give it credit for.
It just sounds like you've got to have sort of a growth of character alongside your growth of wealth, so that, as we've spoken about in this conversation, you know how to use it, how to use it well, and you've got that kind of wisdom around it. But David, as we do wrap up our time today, first of all, thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts and for bringing There's No Free Lunch to life. But in the context of this interview, we do talk about how people can live intentionally, undistracted lives around the purpose they feel drawn toward. How would you say living an undistracted life is supported by how we handle our money?
Well, I definitely believe that when we handle money poorly, just like if we handle relationships poorly, responsibilities poorly, or any other number of categories, we invite distraction into our life. And so by handling our responsibilities correctly, stewarding money responsibly, I believe it enables us to have more clarity and more precision in how we go about executing on the goals and objectives and dreams we have in front of us.
David, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.